Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
It occurred to me that Zone 1 felt, this is about the zombies in New York, Zone 1 felt kind of wild and unrestrained and unbridled.
Sure, yeah.
Was it?
compared to, the voice in this book, definitely.
Yes, exactly right. So how do you think about that? How'd that happen?
Well, I think, just from book to book, I try to mix it up and have different kinds of narrators, telling different kinds of stories. And so, I've been on a sort of perverse streak because Sag Harbor was about growing up in the 80s, and then Zone 1 was about zombie apocalypse. And then I wrote a book about poker, and then this book. And so I'm on a very strange, very odd sort of streak. But it seemed, Zone 1, everyone's dying, and people are quite despairing. And I think that's similar to this book. A lot of folks are living in very tragic circumstances. They're looking for a place to escape to. So in Underground Railroad, they're running north. In Zone 1, they're trying to find a last sort of human refuge where they can be safe. And so while the styles of the narrators are different, there is that sort of story of survival and hope and safety.
And those maybe are some of the similarities. But I guess what I'm asking about is it felt like this story was so big and reaching that you really didn't need to, that you restrained yourself a bit from adding on. Does that make sense?
Well, no. Yeah, I mean, definitely I do have an encyclopedic impulse sometimes, and I don't mind having a 3-page digression on TV dinners, saying Sag Harbor. And when I started this book, I knew I wanted to really have a nice clean sentence is the way I was thinking about it. And
why, though? Why did this book, this story, feel like it needed that and not the other?
Right. Well, I think it's nice to let it rip, and it's nice to be concise. And I think depending on where I am, I'm trying to find different ways of doing things. I've written books which have no plot and sort of coast along on the voice or the main character's perceptions. This book has more of a linear trajectory. And so it's really just, I like trying different approaches and mixing it up.
What happens when a book has no plot?
If you take away one sort of narrative element that the reader looks forward to, like
yes,
straightforwardness, linearity, you have to give something else back. And I think, there are great novels that float along on the narrator's voice perceptions. If you think that they have an interesting way of putting things, looking at the world, then maybe it doesn't matter that there's not an axe murderer chasing them. The narrative stakes aren't incredibly high. They're not looking for, they're not pulling off a heist. You'd like hanging out with this character for 300 pages. And then there's a different kind of narrative structuring you're dealing with. How do you keep the reader invested when there isn't that narrative payoff? But
right,
it's a different sort of way of telling a story.
How much are you thinking about what the experience of the reader is? And when I've asked this question of different authors, some will say, I never think of it, I don't care. I'm writing basically for me.
Well, I think when I'm editing, this paragraph, do what I wanted to do, is a sentence too long? Am I actually getting what I want to get on the page? In a book that's more narrative-driven, am I creating expectations, subverting them, creating suspense, putting in red herrings, misdirecting the reader? So I, of course, know where the book is going. Am I getting on the page? So, I am thinking of that as I'm editing and knocking out pages.
You said something interesting there about, am I creating expectations and then subverting them? How does that work?
Well, I mean, did the butler do it? Who's the murderer? Are they going to escape? I mean, you're trying to figure out, if I give this information on page 10, is it more effective, or page 100? If I'm delaying sort of narrative gratification? Does that work against the story I'm telling, or am I being too obscure? And so you're always like parceling out information to guide the reader through.
At least I like the idea of that, the narrative gratification.
That's like an 80s post-structuralist thing.
What? Yeah.
This still comes out
occasionally. Tell me more.
Well, you know, just delaying and, you know, confusing the reader, making them look over there so that they don't think that the butler did it, you know.
Right.
You know, like in a...
You're making this sound awfully simple, and it's not.
Well,
no.
You know, that's how I'm a simple guy.
You're not. I mean, when you're thinking about how you're going to build that and delay that narrative gratification, there's a lot more to look over there than and don't look here,
well,
right?
I think, you know, in the case of this book, you're in Cora's head. And
right.
You're following her journey, and if she's obsessed with something, if she has an idea about what happened to her parents, you as the reader go along with that, and then you sort of trust that she's a reliable narrator of her experience, and then you use that against the reader to, you know, sneak up on them.
Yeah, you use that against the reader. How do you feel about that reliable and unreliable narrator?
Well, you shouldn't trust anybody. That's, you know, the way I was raised. But you should definitely not trust the narrator.
So. Why? Why?
Yeah, you know, it's in terms of people are, you know, mercurial creatures. In terms of, you know, the folks in your books, you know, they're vehicles for the story. And so, you know, you want them to be credible people on the page, but also, you know, vessels for the ideas and the experience you're trying to, you know, get across to the reader. And so everything they say and do is hopefully serving the story and also, you know, giving the reader a certain idea of what the book is about. And then if you distract them, you can sometimes get an interesting narrative effect.
Did you say that you were raised not to trust anybody?
Well, I'm from New York.
And so that just follows?
Yes. I mean, you know, like I'm on book tour and I have my bag and has my phone. And people are like, oh, you can leave your bag in a green room. I'm like, I don't leave my bag in a green room. Like, you know,
Carrie might go through it. I can't trust anybody. And I might. I hesitate to talk about magical realism because I think the minute we use that phrase, readers have a very specific idea of what that is. How would you describe what that is and then how that's not what it is?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, because I teach writing, I'm supposed to have a good definition of what's fabulism versus magic realism versus fantasy and what's science fiction. I don't. I just think they're different.
You don't?
Degrees. No. So I'm a bad teacher. but, you know, for me, I mean, it's just different ways of using a fantastic element. So I don't really classify it. In this case, I mean, we're talking about this book being more restrained, and I think if I had written this book 10 years ago, the fantastic elements would have been, you know, much more broader.
Why?
I think part of the book is Cora's going on this journey, and each state she goes through is a different sort of state of American possibility, sort of like Gulliver's Travels. And I'm resetting the book every 60 pages, and I think for many years, those different states that she goes to were also not in the 1850 chronology. And so the first place she goes to for many years in the back of my head took place in the future. And they're like genetic experiments and it's very science fiction.
Right.
And then she goes to the next state and there's a different sort of culture and time period. And then to bring it back to magic realism, it was about 2 years ago when I started thinking about the voice for the book. And I reread 100 Years of Solitude, which I had by Garcia Marquez, which I read in high school. And then it seemed, instead of seeing how he dealt with the deformation of reality in that book and the fantastic effects, it seemed, instead of having these really broad gestures, I could just keep it, instead of having the fantastic effects on a Spinal Tap in 11, as I had for many years, if I just put it onto a number one setting, like a sort of simmer.
Yeah.
And kept everything in 1850. How would that change the reader's experience? So there is a literal Underground Railroad in the book, which, of course, is a fantastic gesture. I think the previous version of me could have had very long sort of tunnel sections and describing Cora's experience. But for me, they're really just portals. And so she goes in the subway, into the underground subway, and comes out in the next section. So it's right. So I was less preoccupied with sort of mining all the possibilities of this fantastic gesture and instead concentrating on Cora.
You know, you say that, though, like the previous me 10 years ago would have written the book like this, in kind of a way that sounds like you don't think it would have been as good. But it might have been as good, right? It just would have been different.
Well, you know, I've learned, I had the idea first thing 16 years ago, and I think I've written a few books since then, and so hopefully I'm a better writer. If you stick with something, you get better.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you stick at life, you become a better person, so I probably know more about the world 16 years later, I hope. And so, you know, I'm bringing present me to the topic. I think it would have been good, it just would have been different. In the same way, you flash back to your first year of interviews and be like, oh,
yeah,
it was fine.
Right.
Would have maybe not led with that
attack.
You know?
Exactly. So. What do you think you know about the life and the world now that you didn't know 16 years ago when you started jotting things down about this book?
Well, I was like 30, and I think definitely still in my Gen X sort of douchebag role, you know. You know, I would stay out very late, and when I published my first book, you know, my friend said, so you were working all that time? Like, you were staying out till 4 o'clock every night? And I was like, yeah, well, you know, start working at 2 p.m., but I've settled, you know, settled down, have two kids. And I think about slavery when you're 8, when I first encountered Roots and my, you know, family all gather around the TV set, and think about slavery when you're 18 in college and studying American history. It's different when you're in your 40s and have a different idea of the stakes and what it actually means to see your family beaten, raped, tortured, and sold off, to see your kids, imagine your kids going through that and vice versa. So 16 years, you know, is a lot of time.
There's a lot that's happened.
Change your perspective.
16 years. Tell me about that experience of having your family gathered around and watching Roots.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was like 77 or 76. And in my family, I guess instead of explaining the world, my parents would just say, hey, there's a show on that might explain this aspect of reality. So I remember I was like in fourth grade, and there used to be all these public affairs shows on Sunday morning. Black news anchors had their, you know, 1 half hour. I'm not sure had the same thing here, but there's a guy named Gil Noble in New York had a show called Like It Is or something like that. And they had a thing on like heroin addiction. So instead of like, you know, it's fourth grade, instead of like, you know, my parents saying drugs are bad, they were to say, here's a episode about a guy with like maggots coming out of his arm because he's shooting up in the same place. And
get the message.
It stayed with me, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
So Roots was, you know, the family lesson on slavery.
Wow.
Yes.
That was kind of a quick wrap-up to that question.
And you want to take some more notes?
No, I just made a note about parenting that I'll come back to.
Sure.
All right. Okay, so your parents haven't really said much to you about race and slavery?
Yes.
And history?
And then it's like, luckily, ABC has adapted this bestseller. And so in 8 hours, you know, probably their version would have been like 20 minutes. But,
right.
You stretched out a little bit over a week.
Do you remember, did your parents watch it with you?
Oh, yeah, you know, our three siblings and all of us sort of, you know, got around the TV.
So what do you remember of your parents' experience of that as compared to you and your brothers and sisters' experience with it?
I don't remember. I mean, I think if you're going to go back to the prime TV watching moments, you know, we got cable really early, so we didn't have to talk to each other. And I think my main memories are sort of watching like Muhammad Ali and then Richard Pryor specials and George Carlin specials. So I think I remember those moments where I'd watch, you know, those famous sort of comedians present their life perspectives and they're veering from tragedy and humor instant to instant. You know, you never know what you're going to get from George Carlin or Richard Pryor. And so that sort of way of dealing with the world, you know, I write books that have more jokes, books that have no jokes. This book has, you know, like two jokes in it. My previous book was a humor book. I think, you know, if I'm going to think about the family around the TV, it really was sort of watching like early HBO comedy specials and then also A Clockwork Orange too early, you know. Okay. But
yeah. Do you parent like that?
Well, I'm a big movie fan, so I'm always like, is it too early to show my 12-year-old Alien? It is. Okay, I want to show our Alien. But there is this, you know, scary Twilight Zone episode about the talking dolls, which, you know.
I remember that one.
Yeah.
That is so creepy. It's funny that you, yeah.
Well, they have those marathons now, and so, like,
right.
Christmas Day, and so I'm always like, all right, we're going to watch. Well, that's when a sci-fi channel has them. So I'm always like, we're going to watch the Talking Tina one. We're going to watch the Burgess Meredith one, where, you know, time enough at last.
Someday your child is going to be sitting in an interview and saying, and my dad thought it was great to sit there on Christmas Day and watch evil dolls on the Twilight Zone. And that was our Christmas. And it will explain a lot.
Yes, well, you know.
So
what goes around comes around.
I guess what I'm asking is whether you let pop culture or those, you know, movie experiences kind of stand in for conversation the way your parents did.
No. But, you know, I think most of us are trying to do things differently than our first models did them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't put on the movie version of Go Ask Alice to, you know, I was thinking about late 70s cautionary TV movies. I don't know if you remember, like, Dawn, Portrait of a Teenage Runaway. Anyone? All right, good.
That.
So,
what's the story?
There's like a killer. What do you call a guy who picks up hitchhikers?
Yeah. Yeah, a guy that picks up hitchhikers.
Yeah. And so teenagers are disappearing, and there's Dawn who has to get to work or something. And,
right.
I think at the end, you know, Dawn escapes, but then the final frame is like her sister, who's like even younger, like hitchhiking on the road. So, I think in the modern Gen X parent says, don't hitchhike, instead of, here's a 2-hour ABC movie of the week.
Really?
About the perils of hitchhiking.
Right. It's funny that you knew exactly how many jokes you put in. You said, I put in two jokes, telling us that you were also restraining yourself on humor. The story would demand that, right? But you were also deliberately doing that?
Well, I think, you know, I just couldn't use that sort of a certain satirical register that's very comfortable for me.
Why is that so comfortable for you?
I think it's going to go back to George Carlin and Richard Pryor again.
Yeah?
You know, I think there's a way of dealing with the world where you're stepping back as an artist and observing, and then also to make it real, you have to be in there. And so telling jokes is a way of revealing a different perspective on things. Like you're summing up in a joke, in a one-liner, something that's sort of known to all of us but has never been put in this one sort of pithy way before. And then if you have that sort of broader Beckettian, Richard Pryorian way of dealing with the world, you can tell jokes, move into tragedy, mix it up, and again, you know, you're guiding the reader through this experience. And so jokes and then a sudden turn into tragedy is a way of guiding the reader's experience.
So is it harder to not let yourself employ that tool that, as you said, you feel pretty comfortable? But, well, I mean, were there moments where you thought, Okay, this would be a great moment and easy to...
It never occurred to me. It never occurred to me. It's not one of those lighthearted slavery...
No.
...stories.
No.
that we know so well.
Yeah.
No, I mean...
That's what I thought we were talking about tonight.
Yes.
Jeez.
I think, you know, because I do mix in genres, you know, it's... I know what I'm getting into, and so... There's certain conventions of a coming-of-age story that I want to keep or subvert, and the same thing with a horror novel, and the same thing with a hopefully realistic historical novel. And so I'm sort of all in for this way of telling a story before I start. So I didn't feel hemmed in.
When you say you're all in for this way, what do you mean?
I'm writing a book about poker. I do want to explain the game. I want to have a narrative journey of someone learning how to play poker, me, and then going to the World Series of Poker and playing it. I know I'm going to have to explain how tournament poker works, how the ranking of hand works for the reader. And so that's just part of the challenge of this particular nonfiction book.
Right.
I want it to be accessible to people who hate poker, people who... had their house gambled away by Uncle Jimmy and hate gambling. How can I make it accessible? And,
right.
You know, tell jokes, be self-deprecating, have different strategies. And so you're writing about slavery, but have a fantastic element. How can I make a realistic plantation life before I deform the reader's experience and deform reality? So, you know, I'm sort of considering all that before I start, and it's... you know, part of the ticket before I get going.
The other thing I wondered about was your decisions about how much tragedy and how much pain and suffering.
Well, you're studying, I'm studying slavery and reading slave narratives. And then in the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration hired writers to interview former slaves, people who were kids or teenagers, before the Civil War. And they collected us hundreds and hundreds of these oral testimonies of people who were former slaves. And it's terrible, disturbing, you know, to contemplate the reality of plantation life and the millions who suffered, and some survived. So imagining how I'm going to get that on paper, imagining my own family's journey through slavery, which is, of course, a mystery because... I don't know if they lived and died in Georgia or Florida. You know, that, you know, I can only go back 100 years for most of my family lines. So I want to honor them and everybody else who went through and testify for them. And so that meant being realistic about plantation life. And I know people find this part or that part disturbing, but it really is just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing a book for a year and thinking of things that are appropriate for Cora's journey. But, you know, slave masters watch their fathers abuse, torture, brutalize their slaves, their property, and they were thinking up weird, baroque, sadistic things to keep the slaves in line. So everything I'm coming up with for a year, I'm thinking about it, is nothing compared to the generations of sadistic folks who were devising all sorts of things.
Understood. And I didn't mean to suggest that you were creating things that weren't historically true. But I know you were also making choices about where that was going to go in the story and how much we were going to learn about that, how much Cora was going to witness, those kinds of decisions. That's what I'm interested in.
Well, I think I borrowed from some of the slave narratives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very matter-of-fact about the brutalities of their childhoods, and so they'll just say, in two sentences, you can go from, I saw my mother beaten to death, and the next day I was sold, you know, to a cotton plantation in Georgia. And it's just two sentences back to back, but it contains so much of this person's life. And in the case of the 1930s oral testimonies, they are looking back over the decades and they have the certain distance. So they're describing something that's incredibly brutal.
Right.
But so much has happened to them since then, so they're removed from them. So So I think the voice, the narrative voice, allowed me to shape a lot of the violence in the book and the sort of brutality. I think I wanted to have representative experiences that, you know, spoke to Cora's journey. And then I think the way they work on the page is a factor of borrowing the slave narrative's sort of distance.
Right. What does it mean to you and to your family that you can only trace your ancestral line back 100 years?
It was just a fact. I never really thought about it. There are sort of more enthusiastic genealogists in my family. And so I've talked about that in interviews, and then, like, I got a text from my mom's cousin, Jerry, who sort of can follow one grandparent, one grandparent line to a indentured servant who was biracial, put up for adoption by the Episcopal Church, and then sold or whatever, contracted out as an indentured servant to James Madison. And then she had kids, and they were free black people who owned taverns in Virginia. So my cousin Jerry wanted to make sure that I put that out there, that we do know one line. And it's never, you know, it's never like sort of like a reincarnation. It's never like I was just a carpenter, you know. It's always like I was Nefertiti, you know. So I'm not sure about this James Madison story. I'm not sure about this James Madison story.
I got it.
But that's what I've been told. So it's never occurred to me. I mean, it's sort of like a fact.
Are you saying that Jerry, Uncle Jerry, is an unreliable narrator when it comes to this?
Well, you're, you know, thinking about your audience all the time and shaping your story.
That's right.
Have an effect.
I'm interested in where you found these slave narratives, how you... I mean, and were you, tell me where you, initially where you found them.
I went back and reread the ones I, you know, read in college. And lucky for me, I don't like leaving the house. And so, because this copyright law, they're all in the public domain.
Yeah.
And so I can just download them.
And, this is so unromantic.
And
I pictured you in these libraries and you're turning these old ancient pages and you're.
No, I mean, I was asked, you know, for a magazine to do an interview, like, do you have any, you know, cool historical stuff you can show us for the picture? And I was just like, I have my iPad, you know. all the stuff in the 30s was done by the government. It's ours, it's yours, and it's been digitized by the Library of Congress. And so it's just, it's great that it's so accessible, even if it's not as romantic.
Did you say you don't like leaving the house?
No. I'm from New York. You know, I was going to get mugged or terrorized when I leave the house. So I try to make my, you know, trips out brief and...
Like a book tour.
Spaced out, yeah.
Right, which is anything but. Are you really serious? You don't like leaving the house?
I prefer to stay indoors.
Because nature is frightening, or...?
Well, I have everything I need, you know. I have food. I have television.
I can't tell if you're kidding me or if this is true.
This is true.
Mm. Yeah. All the more interesting.
You occasionally have to take your kids to school or pick them up.
Yeah.
And that's a whole Megillah. But, you know, part of the reason I got into writing was that I just work at home and I don't have to talk to people. And it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it has. So observation, you know, of the world around you is really not something that...
Well, when I do travel, I try to take a lot of notes.
Yeah? On the brief forays when you're out in the world?
You know, coming from my hotel to here, St. Paul, I, you know, got some good fodder.
Did you?
Half an hour.
Wow. You know. Yeah. Is this true?
Well, I was thinking, you know...
No, I don't mean about the St. Paul thing. I mean overall.
I was really... I guess we took this one sort of big street. I forgot what it's called. And I was like, is there any good, like, really great Minneapolis crime fiction?
Is there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, John Sanford writes, yeah.
Because I was reading these Richard Stark novels from the late 60s, early 70s, and they're all this sort of, like, these sort of mid-sized towns that are, you know, sort of made up. And then they had, I was just passing all these really great old buildings, and I was like, I sort of saw these Richard Stark settings.
Really? And then what happened?
Then I was like, any good Minneapolis crime novels I should read?
Yeah. Okay. So. How about an excerpt from the novel?
Sounds good.
You might tell us a bit about where we're at in it.
Sure.
Time's passing so fast, I thought I better get to this.
So Cora and her guide, Caesar. Caesar is a slave who's come down from Virginia. He's been sold south, and he's the one who gets our protagonist, Cora, to take a ride on the Underground Railroad. And they've come to their first station. So they go to a barn, and they look around, and they start to see they're in a very strange place. She saw the chains first. Thousands of them dangled off the wall on nails in a morbid inventory of manacles and fetters, of shackles for ankles and wrists and necks in all variety and combinations, shackles to prevent a person from absconding, from moving their hands, or to suspend a body in the air for a beating. One row was devoted to children's chains and the tiny manacles and links connecting them. Another row showcased iron cuffs so thick that no saw could bite them, and cuffs so thin that only the thought of punishment prevented their wearer from splitting them. A line of ornate muzzles commanded their own section, and there was a pile of ball and chains in a corner. Some of the shackles were rusted, some were broken, and others seemed as if they'd been forged that very morning. Cora moved to one part of the collection and touched a metal loop with spikes radiating toward its center. She decided it was intended for wear around the neck. A fearsome display, a man said. I picked them up here and there. They hadn't heard him enter. Had he been there all along? He wore gray trousers and a shirt of porous cloth that did not hide his skeletal appearance. Cora had seen starving slaves with more meat on their bones than he had. The white man said, some souvenirs from my travels. He had an odd manner of speech, a queer lilt that reminded Cora of the way those in the plantation sounded after they lost their wits. Fletcher, their guide, introduced him as Lumbly. He shook their hands weakly. You the conductor? Caesar asked. No good with steam, Lumbly said. More of a station agent. When not concerning himself with railroad matters, he said, he led a quiet life on his farm. This was his land. Cora and Caesar needed to arrive under the blanket or else blindfolded, he explained. Best they remain ignorant of their location. I was expecting 3 passengers today, he said. You'll be able to stretch out. Before they could understand his words, Fletcher informed him that it was time for him to return to his wife. My part is finished, my friends, he said. He embraced the runaways with desperate affection. Cora couldn't help but shrink away. 2 white men in 2 days had had their hands on her. Was this a condition of her freedom?
You're listening to the season finale of Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with writer Colson Whitehead. His new novel is titled The Underground Railroad, and I'm Carrie Miller. You know, I wondered if, and I don't know that I asked you this last time, if music is meaningful to your writing imagination?
It is. I mean, you know, I, not to go back to New York again, but I grew up with noise. There's always like a ambulance going by, a car alarm going off, someone getting strangled upstairs, and, you know, the apartment above. So there's always like noise around. And so yeah. I find noise very, very comforting. And so when I work. And so I have like it's evolved over time, but with iTunes and the digital blah, blah. I have a playlist of like 2,000 songs, and I just play them
wow.
on this loop. And it goes from hip hop to Kraftwerk to, you know, Peggy Lee, to the Ramones. And they're just songs I just love, you know, over the decades, and they keep me company.
Do you think they enter into the writing at all?
No, well, I think, you know, I'll play some fast stuff, some garage or some electronic, some Daft Punk when I'm about to sit down and I get into a writing mood. I have like 2 cups of coffee and I put on something loud and fast and it gets me going. There are dance breaks. There are sing-along, yeah. You know, the Clash.
What happens during a dance break?
It's just quick, you know, get up.
Seriously?
Not so much as I used to. My back, you know, not as limber as I used to be.
Yeah.
But just that, you know, you can do a lot from your
sing-alongs
ergonomic
too?
Chair. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you've heard London Calling 10,000 times in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll sing along when it comes on.
Just kind of catch yourself sing along with that.
Yeah.
There were some murmurs about your ergonomic chair out there when you said that.
Well, you got to have the lumbar support. You know, you got to have, you know, you're typing, man. Typing all day.
What else is in this writing space of yours? Now I'm curious.
Well, a couch. You got to have your napping couch.
Yeah.
Now there's a TV. So when
Why?
I have my sandwich, I'll have like the horrible news on and
yeah.
Like, that happened, you know.
Right.
Get out of here, you know, sort of yell at the screen. I have a window now. That's a big, I don't always have a window, depending on where I'm living over the years, but I have a window now that looks out upon a tiny little garden space that we have. So. My grill is out there. So I always have something to look forward to, just like my lovely Weber, you know. A lot of good times.
How big of a Weber grill do you have?
Because we're on the first floor, I do a lot of, I have a, in the country where we have a small place, I have a smoker, so I do a lot more smoking out there. But I don't like to smoke sort of big pieces of meat too often because I have neighbors and it goes right, you know, apartment buildings just goes up in a big, you know, and they complain.
Right.
But, you get some ribs, you know, middle of winter, do some chicken, you know.
Yeah.
It's all good.
See? This is what you're here to talk about.
Yeah.
I know.
Yes.
What you're smoking on the Weber grill.
Yeah.
Right there.
Well, this summer I had a big breakthrough, you know, in sauces. You know, I was like, make my own sauce. And so, I like spicy. But then sometimes you have guests over, you don't like spicy.
That would be me.
And then sometimes you're like, screw them. I don't care. I'm going to make it's spicy because I like it.
Burn their lips off.
And it's my house. And then sometimes you want to have it a little more mellower and a little more sugar, you know.
Right.
So
I'm surprised you have a place in the country, given what you said about leaving the house and nature.
Well, once I'm there, I don't leave.
No. Really? You travel in some hermetically sealed vehicle to your country place.
Another 70s ABC movie, The Boy in a Plastic Bubble.
Exactly. Right. That's you.
A lot of formative stuff on ABC.
Right. I know. You know what I was curious about is what you thought about the Bob Dylan Nobel Prize for Literature.
Well, someone said on Twitter, if Trump can be a presidential candidate, Bob Dylan can be a Nobel Prize winner. So.
Oh, boy.
So a lot of unlikely things are happening these days. For me, you know, I was like, whatever. And then I heard Lay Lady Lay in my song loop. And I was like, maybe he does deserve a Nobel Prize last week.
So. Did it really go like that?
Yeah, I was like, this is a pretty good song.
So because at first you were kind of like, what?
No, I was like, whatever, you know, anything can happen. Yeah, it's a crazy world.
Right.
Hurtling through space, big blue marble in space.
Yeah.
And so it seemed fine. I wasn't really, some people were upset.
Yeah, some people were upset.
Seems fine. He's been around the block a few times.
Right. Yeah.
And he's from Minnesota?
Yeah.
Well,
not anymore.
He should get it for that.
He doesn't. He kind of lives in his New York bubble too, right? He tours a lot though, but he doesn't come back here very often.
That's terrible.
Who's ever seen Bob Dylan in? Yeah. Okay. See, you ever seen him in concert?
I never have.
Do you care?
No.
Yeah. I kind of got that.
Well, I do like his music, though.
I kind of got that. So once you heard Lay, 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 Lady, Lay, you were like, okay, there's something going on here.
Yeah, well, you think, you know, you have an affection for artists over the decades. And so I was brought back to hearing it in college. And when I first was writing my first unpublished book, that was terrible. I have a friend named Kevin Young, who's a famous poet. And he would do the writerly thing of going to writer's colonies because he was, like, always on the ball. And I was...
What were you doing?
I had nothing to get into writer's colonies with because I was just, like, a weird, unpublished loser. And so he would go to writer's colonies, and I would go to his apartment. And that would be my writer's colony. And so
That's
we had...
That's great.
And, yeah, it was great. It was in Providence, you know, and so I would... It happened like a few times where he would be a real writer, and I was like the wannabe writer.
Right.
And he had a Bob Dylan box set and a Prince box set, and I would just work to those two, you know, for 2 weeks.
Now you're just playing to the audience. I mean,
no.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
I didn't bring
Prince.
It up.
Yeah, but you're just naming all the Minnesota people.
Oh, I guess I was thinking because.
Yeah.
But those two box sets, it was the summer of 95, and it was a really great.
What's your favorite Prince song?
It's embarrassing, so I'm not going to say it. But whenever I finish a book, I put on one last page, the last couple of pages, I put on Daydream Nation by Sonic Youth and Purple Rain, the album. Mm-hmm. And that's when I know I'm about to finish the first draft.
Really?
And so...
yeah, you know, come on. What's the song? Come on.
It's
just us.
It always calls for a dance break, but Baby, I'm a Star.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have no need to be embarrassed about that. Why would that be embarrassing?
I don't know. It's all like, you know, hey, look me over. Baby, don't you like what you see? It's a little more... disclosing than
you
I
could go with
like
the lyrics
do.
A little longer if you know them.
Yes.
Okay, what is it about the ritual? Because that's interesting.
Well, you know, my playlist is the songs I love, and they bring me back to different parts of you know, moments of my life. Like this John Henry Days is like a Daft Punk Radiohead book. You know, listening to OK Computer, and so you know, the song just brings me back to different times in my life. If you haven't caught on, pop culture is very important to me. I think about it a lot.
The ritual.
It means that somehow I finished the book. It's the ninth time I crawled through glass for like a year. That's how I envision it, writing a book.
Yeah.
And then everything is coming together. All the plot strands are coming, are finally being brought together. Everything that's had to happen has almost happened, except for like the last three pages, and that's going to be like an afternoon's work, a couple hours. And so, you know, putting on those two records means that, you know, I survived without getting hit by a bus finishing a book.
Yeah. So it's a celebratory.
It is, yeah. And, you know, it brings me back to hearing Purple Rain, summer of 83, 84, and then Daydream Nation, fall of 88.
Wow. Huh. So you just sit there and kind of think about what it all means, or?
Well, no, it's just like, you did it, Coulson. And it feels good, you know.
Does it feel like crawling through glass every time?
Yes. Some books have more jokes, and you're like, you're cracking yourself up. You know, like, ha-ha, that's a funny one, Coulson. And then...
Is there really this kind of talking, self-talk going on?
Yes, but yeah, you know, basically.
Just wanted to know. Okay, so glass and crawling.
Yeah, well, you know, you have good days and bad days. Some days, definitely, you're like, oh, that's a new kind of sentence. Or, like, oh, this character, I got this character's voice today. And that's a great feeling. You can't show anybody because... It's not really good. It's not, you know, you have to wait till it's done. You can't say, actually the sheriff is the one who did the murder. That would ruin the whole thing for whoever, you know,
right.
My wife or whatever. So I'm like, I figured something out about the book today.
Yeah.
You'll find out in a year. And I can, and you know, maybe I'll bring up this moment a year from now. And like, remember that day I realized the sheriff did it?
Yeah.
And she'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
I tune out most of what you say.
So. How long have you been married?
I guess like 3 years now.
Okay. She's tuning it out. Yeah, completely. So are you saying that, I mean, the crawling through glass, that means that, you know, when we first started talking, you said, I'm a different person. I'm a more experienced writer in the 16 years when I first started thinking about this book. So does that mean that you don't have techniques or tools that when the glass gets especially sharp that you've learned over this writing career that you can use?
It just means the next day you have to start over again.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to stop writing the book?
But you know, you do know how to get yourself out
of... I know it's going to get done. Like, I don't worry about, will I finish the book? The book always gets done. And if I'm stuck for a month, it's a month where I'm not working. I'll figure it out eventually. I don't, you know, stress about it. You know, so I understand, like, writer's block. It's just like, is it something I haven't figured out yet?
You say you don't understand it?
I don't understand it, you know.
Yeah.
If I haven't figured out this character's voice or who they are, I will eventually, and I'll just have to wait. And then...
Really?
Are one you time that, was like a year, and that kind of sucked.
Are you really that calm about, I just have to wait, because it will come?
There's no other choice, is there?
Yes. Could be like, well, what are you doing in that year that you're trying to figure it out? Writing something else?
No, just walking to Earth. Maybe there's like some villagers being menaced by bandits, and I can go and help them, you know?
You would have to leave the house to do that, wouldn't
just
you?
Damn it.
Superman?
Right. Have adventures, you know, walk the earth.
What? Walk the earth in your apartment?
Yes. You know, whether you're working or not, time passes. And I definitely, you know, in between projects, I always take like a year or a year and a half off just like, decompress or promote the book or teach. And so I'm used to having big pauses in between projects. And, you know, when I'm sick of not working, I'll start working.
Right. What do you know about yourself as a writer that you didn't know at the beginning? Yeah,
that's a good
go
question.
With that.
That's a good question. I'm totally, you know... I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned crawling through glass, and, you know, this book was actually was different. I sort of knew it was onto something. That was, I hit upon something with Cora and the way the narrator was working. That was different, and I started editing myself of my digressions, and you know, in a way, I hadn't sort of self-edited before, and it was working, and I would get to certain sections and think, oh, I'm doing this so much differently than I would have done it 5 or 10 years ago, and it feels good, I'm going to go with it. And so I'm not sure if it'll always be this way with different books, and different books, you know, freak me out in different ways. But with this, like, the voice clicked really, really quickly. I showed the first 100 pages to my wife and my agent and my editor, and they're really enthusiastic in a way that was sort of different than they had been about other books. And so, so that was new, you know, writing this book and feeling very confident from the first couple of pages that I was, you know, sort of firing on all cylinders was different.
Do you buy into the idea that, you know, a writer that's writing at your level has a certain amount of time when you will fire on all cylinders, when you will be at the top of your game? Do you ever feel that urgency?
I think you can get superstitious, like, you know, I definitely, you know, I think there are writers like Philip Roth had like a sort of a nice big run in the late 90s where he was had a string of books that were, you know, sort of critically acclaimed, and in a row. And so he seemed to have phases, you know, you have phases right. where you're in and out. And definitely, you know, I write a book and then no one's particularly interested, and then write a book and people are interested. And, you know, so over 16 years, I sort of know that there's sort of ebb and flow to how your books are being received and then how you're feeling about them and the kind of things you're writing about. So I think people have creative rushes when they are sort of get into a groove, and I think you'd also get cold again. And so, unfortunately, it's too late to become a lawyer or a vet or something, something useful. So I'm just going to keep writing.
Oh, come on. This is so useful.
I'm just going to keep doing these books. And then, you know, sometimes they'll connect with people. Sometimes they might be a little more personal.
And is that okay? When the book that you put out in the world is personal and for whatever reason it doesn't connect the way this does?
It sort of has to be. I mean, it definitely... there's a book of mine called Apex, which has a really sort of clean, Apex Tides of Hurt, which has a really clean sentence. And I think I was like, oh, I was really onto something. I know some people like it. It was disappointing. And then...
To who, though?
To me. You know, just like, oh, I thought I was really...
You mean the reaction?
Yeah.
But the book itself isn't disappointing.
No, the book
you,
is cool. It's still, yeah. You know, little Apex, my little buddy.
Right.
But then you just have to start another one. You have no choice but to start another one, so.
Are you really that casual about it? It's crawling through glass.
Well, what else are you going to do?
Bring these books to fruition.
What else are you going to do? I mean, you know, I think I became a writer after writing a novel that no one liked and realizing that there's nothing else I was going to do that could make me feel whole or functioning or... you know, fulfill me, except write another book. And so whether other people like the book or don't like it, you have to start again. Maybe you have a financial cushion. Maybe you're teaching 4 classes that semester in order to subsidize a summer of writing. Mm-hmm. And then maybe sometimes you're not. But, you know, 6 months from now, I'll just go back to my desk. Well, I'm already at my desk because I'm surfing the internet all day. But I'll go back to my Microsoft Word.
Did you say you're surfing the internet all day?
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking for...
Mostly shopping.
Really? Buying what?
These pants.
Yeah. Are those leather? What are they?
Exactly.
No, are they?
They're coated denim.
Really?
Yeah.
So fashionable. Shopping, is that just a delaying tactic to stop you from getting back to work?
No, I find it really fulfilling.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why?
Is it going to fit? Is it going to look good on me? You know?
There's only so many pairs of coated denim pants you can buy. So what do you move
I
on
beg to
after
differ.
That? I could keep this going for another hour, you know, yeah. Coulson. Another excerpt,
certainly,
if you would.
Certainly.
Okay.
So Cora goes to South Carolina, escapes to North Carolina, and... there's a famous slave narrative written by Harriet Jacobs, who escaped from her master and spent 7 years supposedly in an attic waiting for passage out of North Carolina. And it's inspired this section of my book, where she's waiting. She's been taken in by people on the Underground Railroad and waiting for passage out. To explain why he and his wife kept Cora imprisoned in their attic, Martin had to go back a ways. As with everything in the South, it started with cotton. The ruthless engine of cotton required its fuel of African bodies. Crisscrossing in the ocean, ships brought bodies to work the land and to breed more bodies. The pistons of this engine moved without relent. More slaves led to more cotton, which led to more money to buy more land to farm more cotton. Even with the termination of the slave trade, in less than a generation, the numbers were untenable. All those niggers. Whites outnumbered slaves 2-1 in North Carolina, but in Louisiana and Georgia, the populations neared parity. Just over the border in South Carolina, the number of blacks surpassed that of whites by over 100,000. It was not difficult to imagine the sequence when a slave cast off his chains in pursuit of freedom and retribution. In Georgia and Kentucky, South America and the Caribbean Isles, the Africans turned on their masters in short but disturbing encounters. Before the Southampton Rebellion was smothered, Turner and his band murdered 65 men, women, and children. Civilian militias and patrollers lynched three times that in response. Conspirators, sympathizers, and innocents to set an example, to clarify the terms. But the numbers remained, declaring a truth unclouded by prejudice.
Here's what I wanted to ask you. Ann Patchett did something kind of interesting, and it reminded me to ask you about this. When she's out on book tour, she kind of evangelizes for another book, for somebody else's book. Now, she's a bookseller, so it's kind of a natural thing. But if you could, you know, put a book that's meaningful to you in the hands of somebody else, what book would that be? New or, you know, contemporary or classic? What would it be?
Well, I guess my big book for late summer, early fall was H's for Hawk, Helen McDonald.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just admire people when they find, like, their subject and then have an interesting way of bringing all different kinds of history. I think H's for Hawk is a literary study. It's a memoir about loss. It's about being a person in the world. So I think, in zeroing in on a very sort of seemingly esoteric topic, falconry, you know, she opens it up to encompass so many different segments of human experience.
Right.
And so I really love when a nonfiction writer finds like that one thing and it clicks and it's such a perfect match between writer and subject. It's, you know, it makes me feel lucky as a reader.
Wow, that's exactly the experience of reading Helen McDonald's work. You feel lucky that you had access to it.
Yes, yeah.
It's good. Okay, questions? Just raise your hand. We have microphones, and we'll be right over to you.
Hi, thank you so much for your wonderful books. They're just fabulous. I did have a sort of fantasy of Mark Spitz suddenly coming in and saving the day for Cora at times, but there were some surprise chapters in your book. I sort of thought they were presents for us from getting a different perspective at times. One of Cora's attic captors and Mabel, most tragically, at the end, I thought. Could you speak a little bit as to why you gave us those chapters and what your thought process was?
Sure. No, yeah, thanks for reading. I wanted the book to be very, very controlled in the way that some of my books aren't necessarily controlled. But in opening up the book, so it's not just about the Underground Railroad or slavery, but having a larger conversation about American history, there are things I couldn't get in through Cora's perspective. And so the first thing I wrote is the first chapter in the book, and it's a 6-page biography of Cora's grandmother, Ajari, who's kidnapped in Africa and ends up in the plantation where Cora's born. And just in those 6 pages, I was trying to get an overture of a sort of typical slave's experience. And I got in a lot of stuff I couldn't get in with Cora. And so even though I was reining myself in, I wanted to have those chapters to expand the sort of scope of the book. And so while I did a lot of plotting before I started, one of the discoveries was those sort of smaller chapters, those 6- and 8-page chapters where Caesar gets his voice. Ridgway, the slave catcher, gets his sort of mini biography. And so they became ways of not being hemmed in by Cora's perspective. And then I was playing so much with American history and moving things around. Once we get to the fantastic bits, they became ways of focusing in on different parts of American history and race in America in a way that I couldn't do with Cora.
Coulson, the pants look great.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for coming out of your house and being our season finale. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.